Hello, it's Jen Taub. Welcome back to Booked Up, a podcast that features you, me, and our favorite authors. Today, I'm speaking with my longtime friend and Pulitzer Prize winner, David L. Marcus, about his latest book, Acceptance. A legendary guidance counselor helps seven kids find the right colleges and find themselves. We'll also get into how we met and what it's like to be the cousin of Roy Cohen, the disgraced and disbarred attorney who represented the Senator Joe, have you no sense of decency, McCarthy, and Fred and Donald Trump. Dave Marcus wears many hats. He's a writing coach, career counselor, and of course, writer. He has been a newspaper and news magazine reporter, a high school teacher, and a writing instructor at a business school. In between, he wrote two highly praised nonfiction books. The first was What It Takes to Pull Me Through, Why Teenagers Get in Trouble, and How Four of Them Got Out. And the second, the one we're talking about today, Acceptance. As a staff member of the Boston Globe, Dallas Morning News, Miami Herald, Newsday, and U.S. News & World Report, Marcus was a columnist, roving national reporter, and foreign correspondent. Now Dave speaks to groups about what he learned covering education and parenting. Let's dive in. So, Dave, where are you right now?
I'm on Long Island. That's where I moved after Northampton to work at Newsday.
And I can't quite see your setup. Is this like the living room, or do you have your own office with that fancy leather pleather chair?
It is a pleather, not leather chair. But it is my guest bedroom, which I've commandeered to be my office. It's also my daughter's bedroom, but she's not living here right now. So it is an office, a guest bedroom, and a reading room and a book room.
In my mind, your daughter is in kindergarten, because that's when my oldest, Emily, was in school with her. Is she no longer in kindergarten? I mean, I know my Emily is now grown up and about to head to graduate school, but your child must be still in kindergarten now.
Yes. We did a reverse hormone treatment, and so she's still in kindergarten. So I decided to skip adolescence with my daughter. Yes.
Yeah.
My daughter just graduated from Northeastern University. I think maybe she was inspired by knowing you years ago. She studied criminal justice, and she had internships where she worked for for one thing, she worked for a prisoner legal assistance program at Harvard, and she worked for the Innocence Project, and she really got to know the not-so-good parts of the justice system.
And that's incredible. And so she was kind of commuting from Boston into Cambridge to do that internship, or was it over the summer?
She actually relocated to Cambridge for because Northeastern has, they're not little kiddie internships of 6 weeks.
Oh, right.
Weeks.
They have the co-ops, right?
Right. You know what co-ops are. Sorry, I should have said co-ops. She had a full co-op for 6 months. So she was in Cambridge at Harvard Law School, which is really inspiring. Now she's working in financial fraud, and I hope she will go back to do good things. She also,
Slow down. Oh. She's working in financial fraud, like facilitating it or trying to stop
it? Yeah, she basically bilks people for billions of dollars.
Good
somebody's
girl.
Somebody's got to pay the tuition.
Good girl.
Here. No, she's actually investigating financial fraud, and I hope she will go to law school and do some great stuff, not as a sort of a corporate lawyer making big bucks, but as somebody who's going to take a real serious look at the criminal injustice system, as I call
mm-hmm.
it.
And I'm not using her name because you're not, but you, and then your son is older, right? A little bit older. Was he younger?
He's a couple years older.
And what is he up to now?
Well, that actually goes to our discussion of my book and of college. He tried college for a bit, but he really wanted to work. And so he made an amazing turnaround. This is something I've written about and hope to write about more. He did some internships and apprenticeships, and he now owns his own business, and he roves the country. He's what's called a dog handler. So he takes he has clients, and he takes their dogs to shows. He shows their dogs, and he knows everything about
what?
The medicines and breeds. And yeah, he's really got a thriving business, and it's really neat. People, I've watched him and his clients really, really like what he does. And this is, I wrote about this for the New York Times actually a few years ago, this, you know, this need that I had to, you know, go to the so-called right colleges and all that stuff. But I have learned through students I've worked with and through my own oldest child that there are many, many paths to success.
Absolutely. And I am a, like, I can't even tell you, I'm such a huge fan of the mockumentary Best in Show, but I also like watching the real dog show. So has he been to, like, which of the shows has he been to? I want to go back and watch.
Yeah, he's been to Westminster. And he, and that mockumentary is actually, I think that's really, like, he would tell you, that's like really a documentary about the world he's in. You know, people who have dogs, who show their dogs, are very interesting people and very devoted. And he, but he's really good at you knew him when he was
a young kid.
Yeah. But he also was always like really into animals when we lived in Massachusetts. And he sort of translated that to being into good with animals, but also good with the people who own animals. Uh-huh. And that's a real skill.
Wait, so I want to hear, I know we're supposed to be talking about college, but I really love that we've taken a pre-tour. Is that like what you can call like a prequel, a detour before the tour? We've taken a pre-tour to talk about life, which is as I get older, I have, I also have two kids and I also teach lots of young people. And I just think when, as you said, when we were younger, and maybe it was the era, there was so much emphasis on the brand name school or go to a Big Ten school or go to the place your parents went to. And as if it were like your bar mitzvah, like that, like instead of, you would think like, and let me just make the analogy. Like if you have your bar or bat mitzvah, in theory, that should be the beginning of your Jewish education. Instead, for most of us, it was like, I'm done. I did what you needed me to do. And in treating college like that as the end, as the thing you get as a reward for obeying all the adults in high school, is really not the best. I mean, it should be your entry into the beginning of your life's work, exploring new ideas and finding yourself. And I think that's what I absolutely love about your book Acceptance. But I also love this idea that for some people, college isn't the right path. I know lots of kids from Northampton High here who are friends with my older daughter, some of whom, because of COVID, decided to delay. Others who thought, you know what, I'll get a 2-year degree, community college, and I'll start my own business. And others who it's just not for them. And they're making their way in the world and it works for them. And I don't think it makes any sense to push a student or a young person into some kind of rigorous academic program and lots of debt. And they don't know what they're going to, you know, they're intellectually curious in their own way, but that's not the place for them. So I'm glad to hear about your son. But I want to know more about the dog shows though, because if I go back and watch them, because we've watched them before, I enjoy this, of course, because I love dogs. But which breeds has he run around? Or do you know the names of any of them so I can find?
Oh, my gosh.
Because you can usually only see the handler, like their feet running around. You don't always notice them as much.
Yeah, I mean, he's been working a lot with Labradors now, but he also worked with a lot with what are the African dogs with the stripe down the back of them? It'll come to me in a second. Anyway, Ridgebacks, Rhodesian Ridgebacks.
Oh.
He's beautiful dogs. I mean, really, it's incredible. Dozens of breeds, and he knows the distinctions and the differences and how to groom them and what meds they have to take. I do not want to disagree with Professor Jen Taub, but I will tell you.
Please do.
I will tell you that when you and I are somewhat the similar age, you're younger, I'm sure. But when we were in school, yeah, there was a sort of straight and narrow path that kids were expected to go on. But I will tell you the pressure that I see now, we're talking about higher income, middle and upper income communities. Yep. The pressure that I see on students is intense. The pressure to get into so-called best colleges. And it's the book tour for Acceptance, my book, has taken me all over the country. And I will tell you, whether it's Washington, D.C. area or L.A. or Miami or Boston or New York, and I've been all over, parents come up, students too, and say, you know, how do I get into Harvard or MIT or Caltech? Somebody has decided out there maybe even a magazine I used to work for, US News. Somebody's decided out there that there are sort of 49 whatever acceptable universities in this country, which is ridiculous. And the pressure, the intensity, the you know, putting kids, putting students through this kind of this mill has led to fraud and also has led to depression and anxiety and students.
I agree, it's
like
worse. You're not disagreeing. No. I'm not. It's much worse right. for a number of reasons, in part, but not in total. Something you bring up in your book. I mean, it's sort of a vicious cycle where, because it's harder to get into schools, students apply to more. So there are more applicants, but there's also just more applicants overall because the population grows and has grown and the baby boomers have all these children. And, you know, although a lot of liberal arts colleges have cropped up that are amazing across the country, some of them have had to shut down for financial reasons. And I see that. And also, like you're saying, if there's a short list, even if it's 50 schools, when there's hundreds of colleges, people don't always know about these jewels of places. Like my oldest went to Lafayette, which was the perfect school for her. That's why she's now going on. I'm going to Cavell. She's getting just got into a master's program in astrophysics. This is not, you know, and she loved math and science. She needed those 4 years at a place with the perfect school where Lafayette's known to be like more science mathy, personal attention. But also liberal art, you know, also, you know, humanities focus. She liked theater tech. Couldn't have found a better school for her, but that's fortunate. But she wouldn't have known about it if I hadn't heard about it and did some research. But it's like, and you're nodding because you think that's also a gem of a school too.
I like Lafayette. I've been to a lot of those schools outside Pennsylvania, Lafayette, Muhlenberg and Franklin and Marshall within an hour and change of Philadelphia, some amazing universities. Now, I will tell you that the weird thing is actually the United States is going through an enrollment cliff. There's a population decline actually in that college-age population.
But just now, though, right? Because of the baby boomers, it's no longer their kids.
Yeah, but you're already seeing, you know, some really wonderful schools go under, almost go. I mean, Bennington near you and Hampshire near you almost went under. And so many schools are really on the precipice. And what's happening is that more and more students in the U.S. and overseas are applying to the same 30, 40, 50, 60, 70 universities, colleges in this country. But smaller ones in remote areas are really struggling, and it breaks my heart. It just breaks my heart because there's so many gems out there. So it's an odd situation where American students and parents, again, we're talking about upper middle income, are you know, desperate to get into the same schools, and they're not looking creatively. There's so many incredible colleges out there we can talk about later that are not sort of on everybody's, you know, decal list.
And you know, the one of the sort of central figure in your book, Acceptance, is a college who soon to be at that time when you wrote it, he was about to retire, a college college counselor who worked on college counselor at a high school in Long Island. Graith Smith?
Graith Smith, but everybody just calls him Smitty.
And Graith is spelled unusually. It's like G. How do you spell his first name?
It's like Gwyneth Paltrow without a couple of letters. Yeah, without
yes,
letters.
But it's pronounced Graith. Smitty is what they call him, right?
He's known Smitty, yeah.
And I think that, first of all, I love the way you write. This book is equally as stellar as your first book about the therapeutic boarding school. You have this way of bringing us into the lives of the people in the book, but you also do these settings so well. Like I can visualize the rooms I'm in the way you describe them. But what I love is the contrast that you make between someone like Smitty, who really wanted to get to know the students that he advised and wanted to help them find the right fit and would push back against pushy parents, comparing him to, and I forget who this is, but there was someone else, you know, these terrible, terrible admissions counselors, and some of them just operate off the web, who make these lists of you have to do X, Y, Z, and you want to package yourself this way. And I think they make money just by tapping into the desperation and anxiety of parents for the most part, and then children who are led to believe their life is going to be in shambles if they don't gain admission to, like you're saying, something on this list, and nothing could be further from the truth. And just reading, I have to tell you that my blood pressure went down several, whatever the markations are. I don't even have high blood pressure, but even opening this book, because I have another kid who's a sophomore in high school, makes me feel anxious. And then as I read it, just reading Smitty's wisdom told through, you know, your words, Dave, I relaxed quite a bit. So do you want to, tell me what you think now, because you published this book in 2009 and you wrote it right before the Great Recession. You're mentioning that the demographics are changing because fewer people are applying, but the problem is they're not going to apply to the gems, right? But we also have a new change with the Supreme Court perhaps ruling shortly, and maybe by June, even maybe this month, on its two cases where we expect them to basically whatever was left of affirmative action to end. So tell me what, from a social justice and political fairness point of view, as well as from, you know, parents and junior, you know, sophomores and juniors and seniors in high school now, what does the landscape look like? What's the best advice you can give people looking for acceptance?
Sure. Well, let me, if you don't mind, I knew you before you were a famous pundit. So let me weave a little politics in here, as a little bit, as well as a little practical stuff for parents. So the Supreme Court is ruling on a case about UNC, a state college, University of North Carolina, and a public college, and Harvard, an elite private school. Somewhat overlapping issues. But let's step back for a second. All these people who don't like affirmative action. Affirmative action does have some problems. But what's the real kind of affirmative action out there? Well, for one thing, if you or I give $5 million to a university, $10 million, a gymnasium, whatever.
As if.
Well, not us. But anyway, if you're a legacy of a donor, guess what? Then you're going to get in. And if you're a fifth generation legacy of powerful donors, you can get in.
Absolutely.
And oddly, I should say this because I have a daughter and three sons. You know, if you're a boy at a lot of places, if you're male, you're going to get affirmative action because there's a boy-male crisis in this country, and it certainly shows up on campuses. They don't apply as much. They really dropped out of the higher ed procedures, higher ed in the pandemic. They have not rebounded fully. They have much worse graduation completion rates. So now let's talk about what, you know, the racial, race-based affirmative action. This is just incredible to me, the way this is unfolded, because we are not having a serious conversation about it. Yes, if you go to the elite colleges, and I could bore you with statistics, but often blacks or people of color are from higher incomes than the average ones out there. So yes, it's not always that it's just helping people who need it.
Wait, hold on. Let me just back up. I just want to back up and you say need it. My understanding, at Ivy League schools, I'm not surprised to find black students there who are wealthy, just like the white students or the Asian students. You're going to already find that anyhow. So one, that's one thing. Two, the purpose, when you say need it, the purpose of affirmative action is to deal with hundreds upon hundreds of years of disenfranchisement. And we could go back to no one getting 40 acres and a mule. We can go back to the inability to, you know, the black codes where people couldn't have jobs. So we're talking about generations of racism and segregation. And even if an individual person themselves may be inside of a family that has some wealth, that doesn't erase that history, nor does the fact that there is outright racial discrimination, period, among in this country. There's colorism as well. Anyway, so you can continue.
Well, I oversimplified it, right? But, but my argument, though, is concurrent or agrees with yours, which is that the fact is we have this history of racial discrimination. We have this history of blacks being excluded from higher education, and so I have spent a lot of time with admissions people, and I really come to their defense on this. I really think they're making a good faith effort to open doors, and the Supreme Court any day now, maybe even before this program is out, is going to shut those doors and slam those doors. And And it's pretty ironic to me that Ketanji Brown Jackson recused herself from the Harvard case because she is on the board of Harvard. Her daughter's at Harvard. Now has Clarence Thomas.
She's on the board of overseers for Harvard. Is that the, I get you.
Yep.
I got you.
But has Clarence Thomas, with his many, many, many conflicts of interest, has he recused himself from any case and anywhere? And Clarence Thomas had the gall in October, when this case had hours of oral arguments before the Supreme Court. Justice Thomas said, I don't even know what diversity means. Well, I'm sorry, but we all know what diversity means. And Chief Justice Roberts, who supposedly is sort of a bulwark or a block against the conservatives, he came out very much against affirmative action. And you could tell by his questions. So they have not had serious discussion about that. The fact is that colleges and the military and very few institutions are actually trying to right some wrongs in this country. It's not easy for my kids who are white kids. You know, it's not easy for some other kids. But I look at it as they are doing what they can. Now, what I think they really should be doing is also righting the wrongs about economic discrimination. So people who come from poor backgrounds in the Appalachian, white or Hispanic or black, should certainly get a leg up if they've worked hard in high school and they don't have great counselors. And the real question to me is not affirmative action, but it's a systemic problem. It's a back problem. I've spent years as a journalist going to high schools and middle schools. And I can tell you that you can walk into school and you can know the zip code, you can know the parents' income, you can know everything. If you go to the college guidance office or the counselor's office, the rich schools have counselors who know how to write these recommendation letters. They teach the teachers how to do it. They go to conferences. They mingle with admissions people. And the schools in poorer neighborhoods, and I'm talking about black, white, any kind of neighborhood you want, they don't have nearly the kind of training and the kind of resources. And so those students, great students at those poorest schools all over the country, north, south, urban, suburban, are at a vast disadvantage to applying to college, because you need, when you're 16, 17, you don't know this whole world of college admissions. You need a great counselor like Smitty, who I wrote about.
Mm-hmm. And then there's another layer to this, right? We know that, you know, you were talking about, well, you know, your son, one of your sons, the one who I knew, because now you're remarried and you have two more, right? You're encouraging him. He started his own business. He has that ability to do that. And that's great. And, you know, but for a lot of people in this country, if you look at how the economics work on this, the data shows that a white person with just a high school degree earns more money than a black person with a college degree. Right. And when you add, and that's just overall, even I think controlling for class as well. Right. So, but then on top of that, the cost of higher education, means that sometimes people feel like they need this, you know, not just a 2-year associate's degree, they need the 4-year degree. And yet it's so costly that the amount of debt people who don't have the means, take on becomes a burden that they can't necessarily pay back. And then they have fewer choices about starting their own business with or without a degree. I mean, it's horribly complicated and fraught. And to me, one of the biggest solutions sort of adjacent to what we're talking about is, and you might, even though you say that I'm younger than you, I'm not that much, because in my lifetime, although I was a small child, it was free to go to University of California schools. I think all you had to do is pay, you know, rent or room and board, but tuition, fees, all of the above, you could go to a California school. And I think the federal government should seriously consider, instead of doing, you know, we're going to have to keep people complaining, well, if they do debt forgiveness now, student debt forgiveness, then what about the future? What the future should be is the federal government directly funding higher education so that people can go to public universities without incurring this kind of debt. And I'm not for means testing. I think anyone should be able to go to the public university for free, because some people say, well, then the super wealthy, that's not fair because they can go there for free. And I'm thinking, well, so what? It's good for people to see what the government can do. And then they will have, you know, money comes, then they can spend their money in the local economy of that school. But I just think we've gotten this way that everyone is stressed out about college, what it means, and yet it's so expensive. And now we're adding this layer. There's so much suspicion about these different admissions programs. So let's move to that now. What do you expect will happen? What do you think from your discussions with folks in this realm? What do you think what are they preparing for? Let me say it differently, for the next admission season, which is half through. But you know, what are they going to prepare in terms of what they can do now under existing law, and what you think the likely outcome will be of these cases, and what college admissions counselors will need to do if they actually want to have a diverse student body? I forgot to say one other thing, and I which is, you and I have been talking about how affirmative action benefits individual students, but it benefits even the students who don't directly benefit from affirmative action, because this is the diversity thing you're talking about. Having diverse students from all kinds of backgrounds and experiences is good for everybody.
Well, I will tell you that the colleges I've been talking to are bracing for a crazy, rip-roaring legal battle, because there's a lot of them feel, okay, if you're going to get rid of affirmative action, then you should also get rid of legacy admissions that we just talked about, because you don't want to make sure that you're disadvantaging people who come from poorer backgrounds or who have been excluded from higher education, and yet you're still advantaging people who are third, fourth, fifth generation, who are multimillionaires.
But what's the legal basis? What are they going to use as a legal basis for? Who's going to bring those lawsuits?
Try, but I'll tell you that, you know, regardless of what the Supreme Court does, there's already two states that are chipping away at affirmative action right now. But you know, I think, Jen, this is a thing. I want to just mention the higher cost of education. So in several points in our history, especially recessions, state governments cut back wildly on supporting public education. And I could give you figures on that too, but California, Pennsylvania, Massachusetts have cut back, so that they've really stripped they strip things out of higher education, which we should care about as you know, sort of the leading country in the world. And I actually come to defense of, you know, people always get angry at college presidents and provosts about the cost of higher education. But you cannot give it to AI. You cannot have robots do it. You cannot have somebody in Mumbai
Correct.
Do all of it. And it's a very people-intensive business. And you live in a place, frankly, which I love dearly, in the Valley in Massachusetts, which would be bereft of jobs and bereft of restaurants if it didn't have those thriving colleges. They employ so many people. And parents are, you know, I love dealing with parents because I have, as you started to note, I do pro bono, I do free counseling, and I also coach a few kids a year about how to get into college. But parents will tell me, well, you know, we want these five-star all-suite dorms, and got to have a climbing wall, got to have good food, and by the way, they better have mental health counseling available all the time. And then they say, I can't believe how much college costs. Well, guess what? That costs money. Those are all things that take construction money and bonds and human beings and so forth. So I think colleges are really in a bad position. Yes, the federal government, the states could do more to help private and public education. But let's just say, because I'm on with Jen Taub, so I can say this, let's just talk about the larger issue. I've been crisscrossing this country as a journalist for years. I lived in three other countries for 10 years in Latin America. What are we spending our money on? The military budget has ballooned with no wars, no active wars that we're in. I'm not talking about proxy wars. I'm not talking about helping Ukraine. And your state, Massachusetts, my state, New York, and California, places I've been recently, what we have put so much more money into prisons. And just overall in this country, in three decades, we rose spending on prisons 90%, while higher education funding by the governments was flat or declining. That's what, so you take out mm-hmm. some of that money that we're putting into right. so-called criminal justice, you could have an amazing higher ed system that wouldn't just be four-year colleges, but it would be community colleges that are nimble and viable and respond to needs quickly. It would be certification programs. It would be vocational training, which we have gutted in this country. Uh-huh. You know, you can go, you don't have to go to college. You can go to learn about HVAC, and you can start, in a few years, in a lot of cities I've been to, you could be making $150,000.
Sure.
So money is the objective, which it shouldn't be. We should do that. And then you take Florida, which is making college political, you know, toys. They just gutted they just took the everything out of the new school, which was new college, which was
yes.
an amazing school.
Yes.
It's just, you know, we're having this discussion about little pieces of this problem, affirmative action and so forth in this country, but we're not talking about the fact that we're not responding to the needs of students and businesses, by the way, and the environment and the future. Higher education in all its aspects could be the answer instead of the problem.
Mm. You know, I'm glad you mentioned this area, the Pioneer Valley in Western Massachusetts, and New College. Several of the, I don't even know how many, maybe a dozen of students from New College are transferring up to Hampshire College. I think
Hampshire.
You may have
seen
that.
They got free. Basically, Hampshire is going to let them up. But Governor Ron DeSantis, or whatever, is whatever he's been known as now, is trying to get all the university system, and especially that really cool, interesting, innovative college, to be just conservative bastions. You know, I have spent so much time. I've been to more than 200 campuses.
That's what I was going to ask you about. I want to hear about that. Yeah.
And I'll tell you, you know, at their best, which is not often, but at their best, campuses are places where you go at 18 or 19 or 20, and you have rigorous, real debates about things, and you learn and you challenge yourself and you meet new people and people you never would have met anywhere else. And you prepare for the work world, which in fact is diverse and does involve people from Peru and people from inner cities and people from rich suburbs. And right now, I really fear that these institutions I love, these beloved, these higher education institutions are becoming as fractured and as separated as the rest of society. I know I work with students who won't go to colleges in Missouri, like the amazing Washington University, because basically they're getting rid of the freedom of choice of abortion for anyone who's raped, for anyone. I know students who are afraid to go to University of Texas Austin, incredible school I was just
right.
visiting, because Texas embraces open carry laws. You can bring a handgun, you're almost encouraged to, on campus. I mean, this is all the larger problems of the society, this fractured society, this society which embraces freedom when it comes to assault weapons, but does not allow it for women in their privacy, their bedroom. This country that's made scapegoats, enemies of a few trans kids here and there, who just are trying to live their lives,
mm-hmm.
that's all coming to roost on campuses. And it's really frightening, because campuses should be the place for open debate, for learning about other people, for challenging your ideas. And instead, they're becoming polarized like everything else in this country.
And the only good news on that front was just yesterday, was it, that Jacksonville just elected a new mayor. And Jacksonville is obviously city in Florida.
Second largest city in Florida, by the way. I used to live in Miami. I reported in Jacksonville. That's amazing. That's rebuffing Governor DeSantis.
Yes. The fact that it's a Republican stronghold. So I think people, enough is enough. You know, one parent shouldn't be able to dictate what my kids learn or what's in the library and all the rest of it. So Dave, you have visited 200 colleges and universities over what period of time, and what can you tell us that we, now, in terms of from the point of view of someone who wants to try out something outside of that top 50 or even among them? So, you know, what are the schools for, if you can think about niche schools or types of schools for kids who are curious, who want to find themselves, want that kind of rigorous debate, want there to be some theater, some sports, you know, like a little mini ideal utopian city, but maybe not all that utopian. And where are those places? What, you know, anything else you want to say about 200 schools, which is quite an accomplishment?
Okay, so I'm glad you asked that. So I actually started, speaking of beloved Florida, I started my reporting career before I met you in Miami at the Miami Herald, and I was an education reporter. I have been to schools all over the place. I actually have a few favorites I'm going to mention to you, but they're not all, you know, the best schools are not all in the LA and San Fran area and the Boston area. And there's so many amazing colleges. And I, let me see if I can pull up my little cheat sheet for you, because
I love that.
I want to mention a few of my favorites here. Hold on a second.
Oh, also while you're doing that, can you counsel for free my kid for college?
Yeah, no problem. Okay, so I have a 10th grader too. I have a 10th grader, stepson. And so, basically if she hasn't written her essays and basically done some DNA research, it's over. You know that, right? It's too late. I'm just kidding. I will tell you seriously, Jen, I loved visiting campuses with my kids, because I really felt like our campuses are in this country are architectural gems, and they're just, I love going to school with all my kids. And talking, what did you like? What didn't you like? You know, what do you think about do you feel like women are respected here? Do you feel like there's an open debate? Things like that. So I kind of push my kids to do that. And it's just been an amazing, amazing experience, because we've really sort of learned about the country by going. As I said, we just went to University of Colorado, Boulder, and we went to Texas Austin. We went to Colorado College. And we've had some discussions about, what do you do when a college has freedom of speech and it's a blue dot in Wisconsin or in Texas or in Colorado or North Carolina, but it's surrounded by really intolerant places that don't want women to have choice, that do want everybody to have, you know, assault weapons. And we've had some really interesting discussions about that. Would you feel comfortable living in a place like that? Why do you need to go to college right after high school? What about a gap year? All those things. So I'll just tell you quickly, though, since you asked, I jotted down a few of my favorite places I've been to. St. John's, which is in New Mexico, and Maryland, which is the Great Books Program.
Oh, wait. They have one in New Mexico, too? I didn't know that.
Yeah, Santa Fe, New Mexico. Okay. Beautiful place, yeah. And then Goucher College in Maryland, which is a smaller place where you really get to know your professors. In Florida, not a public school, Eckerd College on the water, beautiful place.
Yes, I have a friend who
not for everybody, but yep. I'm talking about sort of kids who are smart and want to learn and want to be challenged. Rhodes College, which is in another state, which is giving me agitas, Tennessee, a state where there's, you know, booming Nashville, interesting kind of people moving from the north and people who care about Tennessee who are from there in Memphis. And yet, you know, they just took the two Justins in the legislature and tried to toss them out. But they got their
way back in. I mean, right?
Yes.
So, yep.
In part, thanks to high school kids and college kids who protested. Yep. Earlham in Indiana, which is another state, which is problematic sometimes. Reed College in Oregon, where Steve Jobs famously went to and dropped out of. it just goes on and on. And so I'm really hopeful. There's some incredible schools and they're not, as I said, they're not the ones that people ask me about when I go on the road giving talks about college admissions, but they're ones that I think are, you really get an education. You really get to know your peers and your professors. Now, I'll also tell you that State College, University of Massachusetts Amherst has some wonderful, wonderful departments. And I was lucky enough to teach journalism there for a semester. Ithaca College, I taught journalism there when I commuted from Northampton, Mass. They have a great school.
Wow, that's a drive.
School of Communications.
Yeah, they've got a great, great theater school up there too.
Yes. And my wife went there, so I have to give it a plug. And, you know, on and on and on. But I worry that the smaller colleges, I said, are really in danger. There have been a bunch of closings, right? Mount Ida in the Boston area, which really welcomed kids who are different learners, just couldn't make it. And it was subsumed by UMass. And it's just sad.
you have this experience and you have obviously a list. For people listening, is there a website? Where can they find these resources or find you? I mean, do you do any consulting to help people?
Yeah, my name is David L. Marcus, but my website is just davemarcus.com. DaveMarcus.com. I have a list of schools on that I really like. I have some information. I do pro bono. I do, you know, free counseling for people who are going through a hard time. And I take on a few paid clients a year. I really believe in this. And so, Jenna, I actually want to tell you, you asked about the book initially, Acceptance. And so the book is, I was a journalist at Newsday, the newspaper on Long Island, after I left your area, actually. I came here for that job, covered education. And they asked me to do a series for a year on an amazing counselor at a school, a public school, but not a fancy, ritzy public school, just a good public school where middle-class kids go and wealthy kids go and kids from Section 8 housing go. And at Oyster Bay High School, kind of, you know, on the north shore of Long Island, nice place, I found this amazing counselor who's called Smitty. And as it happened, he was finishing up his career. And so I spent a year there doing this series for Newsday. And then another year, his final year there, watching him work with kids and families. And his whole thing is, and this gets to the essence of what I was saying, but I didn't say it succinctly. His whole theory is, it's not about the brand, it's about the fit. I went to Brown, I did a fellowship at Harvard, but the defining moment in my education was at night when I was a journalist in Florida. I went to Palm Beach to a community college in West Palm Beach, and I learned Spanish because I wanted to become a foreign correspondent. It didn't work for me at an Ivy League school that I went to as an undergrad. But there I found plumbers and electricians and people who had to learn Spanish. It was not like a little game for us. It was not about GPAs and getting into grad school. It was about learning. And that changed my life. So I'm a big proponent of this. And if I was the czar of whatever, I would make every high school graduate or every 18-year-old in this country do a year of service and grow up. And I would frankly tell families that the students should take another year and have a job as busing tables in a restaurant or working in a supermarket doing tutoring or whatever. But we don't have that. We have this feeling among, you know, the middle and upper classes that you have to go right into college, you have to excel. But life is more complicated. And education is not sort of a stint of kind of quick races, but it's an enduring lifelong process. And we have to rethink all these things. But I just even when I work with students, I sometimes say, maybe you should take a year off before you go to college. Just get a job, you know, just read some books, do some stuff for free on Khan Academy, go to your community college and learn a trade or learn a specialty or learn a language. Mm-hmm. I will say that 99% of them don't listen to me, but once in a while they do. And they just thrive. And you can see, if you talk to college admissions people and you look at the studies, students who take a gap year after high school are much more likely to thrive in college, much more likely to graduate in 4 years in college, and much more likely to have better GPAs.
I definitely, as an educator, you know, I taught at UMass at the Eisenberg School, and now, and I was at Vermont Law School, now I'm at Western New England, and I absolutely love it there. And we have a lot of first-gen undergraduates, as well as the law school, which has been around for 100 years there. And I notice for sure that people who have taken time off, that first of all, they really want to be there. And this includes the night students. I taught civil procedure, which is a course on how the federal courts work, to the night students this past fall. And I thought that they were going to be phoning it in because they're working full-time jobs and then coming to school at night. And, you know, they were really committed. Their time was precious. They knew why they wanted this degree. And they were also, and I know this is a professional school, so we're not talking about a liberal arts class, but even when I teach classes that are more, perspective oriented or writing and not so much doctrine, the kids who have taken that time off want to enjoy learning. They want to do their work, and they're less anxious, to be honest. I think they're, because they can kind of see where what they're doing is going to fit in the world. So that's absolutely true. But it's hard to it's scary, I think, for parents and for kids to kind of get off that merry-go-round because they're not sure if they're going to get back on. And I think what you're saying is it doesn't have to be a merry-go-round. It can be, you know, an adventure if you're ready for it. So,
and also the college process, you asked about 10th graders. So college process, again, to me is, you know, so much of what we do is we make it about SAT scores or ACT scores, or even now when tests are optional at some schools, we make it about GPA, we make it about numbers and data and chances and what's the admissions rate. It should be ED, early decision, or early action, or early decision two. But what it really is, and what I learned from Smitty writing this book, Acceptance, is that it's a journey of self-discovery. Mm-hmm. We are in a country that we don't have a lot of rituals for our kids. We don't really have coming of age rituals unless you're in religious or affiliated with some kind of synagogue or church. Or what is a coming of age in this country generally? Getting a driver's license. But the way I see it, the college admissions process, the process, looking at schools and thinking about schools and going online and watching videos and asking about schools and thinking what you want to study. That's this amazing journey of sort of leaving your adolescent self behind and starting to become an adult. And even if it ultimately means you don't go to college or you delay college or you go to community college, that's okay. But in so many families, we see it as this kind of this desperate grab for the prize, but the reward is in this incredible journey of a student and a mother and a father or a grandparent or whoever it may be, or a mentor, realizing, you know, what do I want to do? And do I want to give back to community? Or some people want to make a lot of money. I get that. My path was to journalism, so that was not my path, but it's really a chance to step back and think. And also, do I want to go to school where my ideas are challenged, where I have debates with people, where I find speakers from different backgrounds and different professions? My alma mater, Brown, and Amherst College near you are making a really big effort to get students who've come from community colleges and they've done something, or they've been in the military and they have a different perspective, a different life story. And that's enriching, because a lot of the other students who go to these schools have never ever spent time with kids, students, young people from different backgrounds.
I think it's so critical. I want to kind of shift now, because you wear many hats, and obviously the theme through all of this, through the incredible knowledge you've accumulated and wisdom, is that you do this through writing. And in addition to publishing two books, you've also, through journalism, I think that's what you are, Pulitzer Prize winning writer. And you also now, in connection with your writing experience, you do editing or consulting on writing. What is that business?
Well, I really thought I'd do the coaching full time, but I do like doing communications and writing. And so I do some freelance writing and actually work for a nonprofit. I'll tell you about another time doing communications for them. They're trying to get businesses to give back to education. I just started that job and it's really a wonderful, wonderful job.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. The challenge I do in my day-to-day job and in everything else is to think that people are really busy and you have just seconds to get their attention. And how do you write true, interesting, compelling stories? And so you talked before about describing places. Like, a big factor for me, Jen, was living in Northampton, where Tracy Kidder lived and all these amazing nonfiction narrative writers.
Jonathan Haar, for example.
Jonathan Haar, a hero of mine. And so I really studied their writing, because when I'm working with students writing essays, I say, your job is to write, to put a YouTube video in 650 words or whatever it may be, sometimes 400, sometimes 250 words. How do you tell a story? How do you show it? How do you make me feel it? How do you make it visceral? How do you choose the right details? How do you make it active voice? How do you avoid using stuff that's vague or boring? How do you keep it true as possible to real life? And I love that challenge. And I loved, well, I should say this, I hated looking at the blank screen and starting my books, my two books. The first one is actually about a bunch of teenagers who get sent to Western Massachusetts because they have drug problems and acting out problems, and they have, they're sort of struggling teenagers, but they're amazing, wonderful kids. And so it's called What It Takes to Pull Me Through. And I lived with them, as you know, basically in a school in the hills of Western Massachusetts. I love those kids. And I tried to peel back the labels, you know, the ADD kid and the depressed kid, and find the real person under that. And it just was this patience of listening to them and reading their journals and talking to their parents and going to therapy with them. And it was a magical experience. Just like acceptance was sitting with the counselor and then sitting with the families and saying, who is this kid? Like, I have a kid in acceptance who's the jock. And everybody thinks he's just a goofball and his grades are not great. But they find, the counselor finds, as we go on, this is all true stories, that this jock, this kind of goofy kid, they think, on Friday nights, he doesn't go out partying because a relative of his had a drug problem, a mom, and they had to take in these young nephews and nieces. He had to care. On Friday night, he was babysitting for his nephews and nieces. It wasn't that he was going out and getting drunk. It wasn't that he was goofing off. His homework, you know, suffered because he was always the sort of a caretaker while he was being a star, a great athlete. And so I want to, real life is nuances. It's not the crap we see on Fox News and the headlines that we see on so-called, on what used to be, you know, what is now CNN, what used to be a news station. Real life is so complicated and so complex and so rich. And so what I love doing is telling these stories one by one or in a book about the lives we live, about the you know, every family I know right now is going through a kid with anxiety after COVID, or a student who's struggling in school, or another one who's wants to transfer. I anecdotally, I've been trying to work on a story about this. Anecdotally, I think a lot of students are trying to transfer from colleges because they applied sort of in amid or at the tail end of COVID. They didn't visit enough schools. They didn't really know who they were. They missed 2 or 3 years of real school. And we've got a crisis in this generation, not to mention the boys are, you know, you have daughters, but the boys are in even more of a crisis, if that's possible.
Yeah. I mean, I think COVID kind of dropped a grenade on the adolescents for so many kids. But, you know, people have these experiences in life. Life is nuanced. And I think it creates, you know, with this tragedy, are certain opportunities to, and I think this is true with parents and guardians of these kids, to say, you know, let's focus on mental health. Let's focus on a good fit. What things really matter, you know, in your families. And I mean, for me, that's always been the case. But it's hard, though, as a parent, because we forget, as much as you try to remember what it's like to be a teenager and how little you know of the world, you have to really put yourself back in their shoes in order to understand. And even more so now, you're saying tremendous pressure and anxiety. We don't want to add to that. We want to make this a gateway, a doorway into their future, not something fraught.
But it's not, you know, there are no easy answers. Like in acceptance, I have a story of a young a student whose parents are both first generation, you know, who are both immigrants. And so he's the first generation to grow up in the U.S. And like many immigrant families, including mine a couple generations ago, they wanted their kids to be doctors or lawyers or engineers or... But in this case, the kid's like, I kind of like philosophy, I kind of like theater, I kind of like, and you know, there's no easy answer. I understand the parent's perspective because I've talked to those parents and I work with students like that. But I understand the student who's now an American and wants to be an American with all the varied possibilities that means. And when I work with students, I find this constantly with, you know, students whose parents came from another country and feel this pressure, but the student just wants to be in drama, you know, and like, and the parents are like, what are you talking about? Like, we worked in this restaurant, you know, 7 days a week, 20 hours a day, so that you could go on to engineering. And I find it with, you know, with actually, of course, third, fourth generation American kids who say, you know, I don't want to go to college. And the parents are like, what are you talking about?
I have a recommendation. Anyone who brings it up, you should give them or tell them to read my friend Wajahat Ali's book, Go Back to Where You Came From. He was on the show.
I loved the interview you did with him. I know him. I followed him. I heard you and Mary Trump talk to him, but I didn't know his whole story. Now I'm reading his book. He is wow, that is what he's gone through to help his parents and be helped by his parents and to suffer with his parents and to, oh my gosh, that was like, that's the American story for all its glory and all its
yes.
infamy.
Yes, so true. So before we wrap things up, I want to ask you, what did I leave out? What didn't I ask you that you want to talk about?
You didn't ask me like how I developed this six pack just having lived. No.
I mean, you look fantastic. I mean, I can't believe you've been doing like, you know, been hanging from that gravity bar doing pull-ups and you did your whole like weight circuit while we were talking.
Yeah.
your resting heart rate must be so low because you're not even like building up a sweat. You're not even breathing heavy, Dave. You look fantastic.
So anyway, I'm actually drinking coffee. Not good. Jenna, I just want to mention a couple of things. One is that we touched on this, but I am worried on campuses that there's a mental health crisis. I am really worried. I work with students, but I also hear from other students who want transfer, as I said. And sometimes parents just call me for advice. And, you know, we have this epidemic of kids, young people who don't really know how to interact with others or don't really know how to find help and aren't really independent. They don't know how to get around a city by themselves and so forth. And so I worry about that on campuses. And I do think campuses are trying to help, but a lot of schools just, there's not enough counselors, enough attention to that. And then the other thing is that I will just say again that I think we need to pay more attention to the other paths besides four-year colleges. And we need to pay more attention to the origins of this issue, which is high schools are, I don't know why, I just feel like after visiting so many high schools around this country, we're not teaching kids to be critical thinkers. We're not teaching kids to look deep at issues. And artificial intelligence, AI, and ChatGPT and all those things, I think are going to be really, really disruptive and really frightening. Yes, they're fascinating to play with. I use them all the time, but you're going to have students using them to write their essays in schools and in colleges. But when they get to a workforce where they have to write a cogent email or a small presentation, I think they're going to be in trouble. Now, I know they can use ChatGPT and so forth for those things, but this new technology, we are not ready for it. And I will tell you, having experimented with it, it will spew out false information the way Donald Trump does. And just with this sort of assurance, and you read it and you say like, well, I didn't realize the Civil War happened 5 years ago. You know, well, maybe it did 2.5 years ago. But there's just a lot of things that we're not keeping track of. And the final thing I'll say is that this polarization I talked about is leading to some really interesting things. I think I saw a survey recently that a third of one group feels that college is not necessary. One political party. What political party would you think that would be?
I would think that would be what is now calling itself the Republican Party.
Right. Not the Republican. My first job was actually working for a Republican in New York who was a center Republican who cared about people from all different backgrounds, was wanted to be fiscally responsible, cared about women's rights. A third of Republicans, more I think, feel that college is not necessary. Now, I just told you, I think in many cases you can take an alternate path, but I think it's a good thing for this country to believe in higher education. It's a good thing, especially for people who need to step up. And yet, that's a situation we live in. So, you know, the reason I love writing about education, the reason I've written two books about education is that I think that that is a lens we can look at race and relationships and the environment and our aspirations as a society. The last thing I'll tell you, because you're going to ask me this, is you're going to ask me, what are you working on now, right?
Oh, shoot. I forgot to ask you about Roy Cohen. Oh, my God.
Oh, good.
Your
I was
cousin.
Hoping you'd forget.
Oh, no, I want to hear, what, are you writing about him next?
I'll say really briefly to that topic. So for those of you who don't know, Jen does, my dad's cousin, my cousin, was the infamous Roy Cohn, who was the mentor and creator and proponent and advocate and all-around instigator of a young Donald Trump, and also who made Rupert Murdoch possible because he he got Rupert Murdoch in touch with Ronald Reagan when he was president, or when he was running for president, and then when he was president. And so Roy Cohn was an evil, heinous person. I thought about writing a book about him years ago when he died. I got offers to because I wrote a Vanity Fair story about him. And I decided ultimately, this is my wisdom, so you should not trust anything I say. I thought, when Roy Cohn died years ago of AIDS at age 59, I thought, well, who would care about Roy Cohn in the future? Like, why should I spend a couple of years digging into archives? And also, I'd interviewed him, digging into my own interviews with him about putting Julius and Ethel Rosenberg on the death row, having them killed, about his infamous lying to investigators about Studio 54, about representing Carmine DiSapio and other mafia heads. Who would care about him, a few years from now? Well,
what about Joe McCarthy? You left him out.
And Joe McCarthy, he actually, speaking of witch hunts, which he liked to say, and Trump likes to say, he orchestrated a witch hunt with Senator Joe McCarthy from Wisconsin, an evil, evil person also. I thought there was no interest. And so there are many times when I regretted my choice to move to Latin America instead of writing that book, but that was fate. I am thinking about writing something besides op-eds and so forth about him, but there's two things that call to me. That one is, I think there's a lot to be said about education in this country because it's really not where it should be for an advanced democracy or quasi-democracy that we are. So I'm looking into doing another book about education. But also because I've been through a divorce, I actually think there's an interesting story with my wife, who's a life coach, an interesting book about divorce and making a thriving blended family and coming back after divorce and making sure that your kids have some kind of good values and good ethics. I know divorced people who've been sued for $25 million by exes. I know all kinds of crazy stories about exes who stalk them and haunt them and take them to court and stuff and take their kids to Child Protective Services. And I sort of collected those stories. And I think we could do better as a society. The fact is that if you can come back after divorce, you can really do right by your kids, and that's important. So I'm toying with all those things because I still love reading books, as you do. I still love writing books. I still love telling true stories.
I would read anything you wrote. So the divorce book sounds fascinating. I would also read a book on Roy Cohn. And if you don't want to write it, I'm just going to put it into ChatGPT and see what comes out, Dave.
I've done that. ChatGPT and those artificial language models, they get some interesting things right about Roy Cohn, but they really get things wrong. I mean, and I'll tell you, Jen, seriously, like he was a heinous person. I interviewed him when I was in college because I was interested in he was a relative and he had stories to tell. My father would never talk to him after they were teenagers, but I learned from him and I really didn't think that anybody would emulate what he did, which is lie, go on the offensive about anything, never admit you're wrong, never admit that anybody, and go after people who were sort of, weaker than you and exploit every opportunity you can to ruin people. Don't pay bills. Does this sound like anybody you've heard about?
I can't think of it. It will come to me. Yeah.
Maybe ask your friend Mary Trump if she knows anybody like that.
I'll see. I don't think she does, but I'll try.
So his lessons are unfortunately in the air right now. And I'm talking to you as you heroically, E. Jean Carroll heroically took him on and took on Trump. And I just sometimes despair, Jen, but I, like you, I bump into really good people. Really people who really care, really want to do the right thing. I want to single out, actually, my congressman, George Santos. Oh, no, sorry. George Santos is actually my congressman, and I'm just appalled by
my Republican. You should never have voted for him, David.
I did not vote for him, but guess what? I've told my Republican friends who won't stick up, won't say, get rid of this guy. Like, the Republican Party has lost its way. Like, it actually had some really honorable people years ago, and the fact that they won't go after him, the fact that they're so afraid of what this will do to Kevin McCarthy and so forth is atrocious. But I really do think, Jen, it all comes down to education. If we can't educate our students to think critically and think for themselves and challenge things and look up facts and do research, we're really, really in trouble as a society. And that's why I want to write more about education and the possibilities of education.
Well, I'm gonna let you have the last word, which will be a word or two in answer to this question. But now that Santos is probably going to be pushed out and he's your member of Congress, have you considered running for that seat? I think you'd be fabulous.
You know what's so funny, Jen, is that we have a woman, Anna Kaplan, who I think is great. We have some really, really interesting people on the rise. But what's funny is that you sort of, you don't know this, but you sort of got at my sort of secret dream. I really wanted to be a stand-up comedian when I was in high school, and
what?
I still do.
And David?
I just think that would be like, I think it's good for anybody who has neuroses to work them out on stage. And but my second thing was I wanted to come back from 10 years in Latin America and run for Congress. I decided that somebody who's divorced probably doesn't have a great chance.
I don't really think that matters anymore.
That probably doesn't matter. I guess we had a president who was divorced several times too. But anyway, I just decided that I don't know that the sort of the fundraising and the sucking up to donors and all that stuff. But I thought it would be really fun to go to Congress, even for one term, idealistically, and just battle the bullshit and sorry about using that word, and fight for the people who don't have a voice and care about education and question that, you know, our blind spending on military. Look, I have a lot of friends who've served in the military, and I love that, but they will tell you there's incredible waste that nobody wants to talk about except for Jon Stewart, a comedian. And we don't care about veterans, really. We care about the image of veterans. And so I still hold on to this dream.
I'm taking that as not a no. It's not a no.
You're taking that as George Santos has opened a space for good people. I mean, New York State, which supposedly is a liberal state, sent this incredible legion of really not caring Republicans to Congress this time. The reason that the Republicans control Congress is not because of Alabama or Mississippi or Louisiana. It's because of New York State, my state where I was born, which I've seen go to hell in terms of, I mean, there is a crime problem. There's no doubt about it. There's no leadership in Nassau County or Suffolk County. There's no discussion of real issues like the, you know, how much we're spending, as I just said, on prisons in this state is unbelievable. How we're not innovating education, how we're cutting back on vocational ed. So yes, the answer is in my dreams, I would run for Congress.
And there we have it. We're breaking some news. We're breaking some news in the Booked Up podcast, Dave L. Marcus for Congress. Thanks, Dave.
Thank you. I only have one vote and you live in Massachusetts.
That was fantastic. I could have spoken with Dave for so many more hours, and I'm just going to have him back on when he decides to write his next book, whether it's on how to have a good divorce or survive one, or I'm super interested in the prospect of him writing more about his cousin, Brightcount. I'll be back next week with another show as we continue to explore the writing process and the nonfiction world together. Please let me know what you think. Send me an email to bookedup@politicon.com. You can also write to us at bookedup at P.O. Box 147, Northampton, Massachusetts, 01061. To keep up with the show and our featured authors, follow Booked Up on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And please give Booked Up a 5-star review. It really will help other people find us.